This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our show. We're reading from Thomas Hardy's final novel, Jude the Obscure, first published in 1895. Like much of Hardy's work, this book is quite critical of that era's British society. The novel's divided into six parts, each part into several short chapters. Each part will be read by a pair of readers who alternate chapters. This broadcast is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Stuart and Lisa Jonap will be reading the final two chapters of Part 4 of the book. As we move into Part 5, Lauren Armitage will be reading the odd chapters, and Megan Mercerborn will be reading the even chapters.
Chapter 5. 4 and 24 hours before this time, Sue had written the following note to Jude. "It is as I told you, and I am leaving tomorrow evening. Richard and I thought it could be done with less obtrusiveness after dark. I feel rather frightened, and therefore ask, please be sure that you are on the Melchester platform to meet me. I arrive at a little to 7. I know you will, of course, dear Jude, but I feel so timid that I can't help begging you to be punctual. He has been so very kind to me through it all. Now, to our meeting. S." As she was carried by the omnibus farther and farther down the mountain town, the single passenger that evening, she regarded the receding road with a sad face, but no hesitation was apparent therein. The up-train by which she was departing stopped by signal only. To Sue it seemed strange that such a powerful organization as a railway train should be brought to a standstill on purpose for her, a fugitive from her lawful home. The 20 minutes' journey drew towards its close, and Sue began gathering her things together. At the moment that the train came to a standstill by the Melchester platform, a hand was laid on the door, and she beheld Jude. He entered the compartment promptly. He had a black bag in his hand, and was dressed in the dark suit he wore on Sundays and in the evening after work. Altogether, he looked a very handsome young fellow, his ardent affection for her burning in his eyes. "Oh, Jude!" She clasped his hands with both hers, and her tense state caused her to simmer over in a little succession of dry sobs. I'm so glad. I get out here?" "No, I get in, dear one. I've packed. Besides this bag, I've only a big box which is labeled." "But don't I get out? Aren't we going to stay here?" "We couldn't possibly. Don't you see? We are known here. I, at any rate, am well known. I've booked for Albrickham, and here's your ticket for the same place, as you have only one to hear." "I thought we should have stayed here," she repeated. "Oh, it wouldn't have done at all." "Ah, perhaps not. There wasn't time for me to write and say the place I had decided on. Albrickham is a much bigger town, 60,000 or 70,000 inhabitants, and nobody knows anything about us there." "And you have given up your cathedral work here?" "Yes, it was rather sudden, your message coming unexpectedly. Strictly, I might have been made to finish out the week, but I pleaded urgency and I was let off. I would have deserted any day at your command, dear Sue. I've deserted more than that for you. I fear I am doing you a lot of harm, ruining your prospects of the church, ruining your progress in your trade, everything. The church is no more to me. Let it lie. I am not to be one of the soldier saints who row on row, burn upward each to the points of bliss, if any such there be. My point of bliss is not upward, but here." "Oh, I seem bad, upsetting men's courses like this," said she, taking up in her voice the emotion that had begun in his, but she recovered her equanimity by the time they had traveled a dozen miles. "He has been so good in letting me go," she resumed, "and here's a note I found on my dressing table addressed to you." "Yes, he's not an unworthy fellow," said Jude, glancing at the note, "and I am ashamed of myself for hating him because he married you. According to the rules of women's whims, I suppose I ought to suddenly love him because he has let me go so generously and unexpectedly," she answered, smiling. "But I am so cold, or devoid of gratitude, or so something that even this generosity hasn't made me love him, or repent, or want to stay with him as his wife, although I do feel I like his large-mindedness, and respect him more than ever. Well, it may not work so well for us if he had been less kind, and you had run away against his will," murmured Jude. "That I never would have done." Jude's eyes rested musingly on her face. Then he suddenly kissed her and was going to kiss her again. No, only once, please, Jude. That's rather cruel, he answered, but acquiesced. Such a strange thing has happened to me, Jude continued after a silence. Arabella has actually written to ask me to get a divorce from her, in kindness to her, she says. She wants to honestly and legally marry that man she has already married virtually, and begs me to enable her to do it. What have you done? Well, I've agreed. I thought at first I couldn't do it without getting her into trouble about that second marriage, but I don't want to injure her in any way. Perhaps she's no worse than I am after all, but nobody knows about it over here, and I find it will not be difficult proceeding at all. If she wants to start afresh, I have only two obvious reasons for not hindering her. Then you'll be free. Yes, I shall be free. Where are we booked for? She asked with the discontinuity that marked her tonight. Aldbrickham, as I said. But it will be very late when we get there. Yes, I thought of that, and I wired for a room for us at the Temperance Hotel there. One? Yes, one. She looked at him. Oh, Jude! Sue bent her forehead against the corner of the compartment. I thought you might do it, and that I was deceiving you, but I didn't mean that. In the pause which followed, Jude's eyes fixed themselves with the stultified expression on the opposite seat. Well, he said, well? He remained in silence, and seeing how discomfited he was, she put her face against his cheek, murmuring, Don't be vexed, dear. Oh, there's no harm done, he said, but I understood it like that. Is this a sudden change of mind? Oh, you have no right to ask me such a question, and I shan't answer, she said, smiling. Oh, my dear one, your happiness is more to me than anything. Although we seem to verge on quarreling so often, and your will is law to me, I'm something more than a mere selfish fellow, I hope. Have it as you wish. On reflection, his brow showed perplexity. But perhaps it is you don't love me, not that you have become conventional. Much as under your teaching I hate convention. I hope it is that, not the other terrible alternative. Even at this obvious moment for candor, Sue could not be quite candid as to the state of that mystery, her heart. Put it down to my timidity, she said, with hurried evasiveness, to a woman's natural timidity when the crisis comes. I may feel as well as you that I have a perfect right to live with you as a thought, from this moment. I may hold the opinion that in a proper state of society, the father of a woman's child will be as much a private matter of hers as the cut of her underlinen, on whom nobody will have any right to question her. But partly because it is by his generosity that I am now free, I would rather not be other than a little rigid. If there had been a rope ladder and he had run after us with pistols, it would have seemed different, and I may have acted otherwise. But don't press me and criticize me, Jude. Assume that I haven't the courage of my opinions. I know I'm a poor, miserable creature. My nature is not so passionate as yours. He repeated simply, I thought what I naturally thought. But if we are not lovers, we are not. Phillotson thought so, I am sure. See, here is what he has written to me. He opened the letter she had brought and read. I make only one condition, that you are tender and kind to her. I know you love her, but even love may be cruel at times. You are made for each other. It is obvious, palpable, to any unbiased older person. You were all along the shadowy third in my short life with her. I repeat, take care of Sue. He's a good fellow, isn't he? She said with latent tears. On reconsideration, she added, he was very resigned to letting me go, too resigned almost. I never was so near being in love with him as when he made such thoughtful arrangements for my being comfortable on my journey and offering to provide money. Yet I was not. If I loved him ever so little as a wife, I'd go back to him even now. But you don't, do you? It is true, oh, so terribly true, I don't. Nor me neither, I half fear, he said pettishly. Nor anybody, perhaps. Sue, sometimes when I am vexed with you, I think you are incapable of real love. That's not good and loyal of you, she said, and drawing away from him as far as she could, looked severely out into the darkness. She added in her tones, without turning around, My liking for you is not as some women's, perhaps, but it is a delight in being with you, of a supremely delicate kind, and I don't want to go further and risk it by an attempt to intensify it. I quite realize that, as woman with man, it was a risk to come, but as me with you, I resolve to trust you to set my wishes above your gratification. Don't discuss it further, dear Jude. Of course, if it would make you reproach yourself. But you do like me very much, Sue. Say you do. Say that you do a quarter or a tenth as much as I do you, and I'll be content. I'll let you kiss me, and that tells enough. Just once or so? Well, don't be greedy, boy. He leant back and did not look at her for a long time. That episode in her past history of which she had told him, of the poor Christ Minister graduate whom she had handled thus, returned to Jude's mind, and he saw himself as a possible second in such a torturing destiny. "This is a queer elopement," he murmured. "Perhaps you are making a cat's paw of me with Phillotson all this time. Upon my word, it almost seems so, to see you sitting up there so prim." "Now you mustn't be angry. I won't let you," she coaxed, turning and moving nearer to him. "You did kiss me just now, you know, and I didn't dislike you to. I own it, Jude. Only I don't want to let you do it again, just yet, considering how we are circumstanced. Don't you see?" He could never resist her when she pleaded, as she well knew, and they sat side by side with joined hands till she aroused herself at some thought. "I can't possibly go to that Temperance Inn after you're telegraphing that message." "Why not?" "Well, you can see well enough." "Very well. There'll be some other one open, no doubt. I have sometimes thought, since you are marrying Phillotson, because of a stupid scandal, that, under the affectation of independent views, you are as enslaved to the social code as any woman I know. Not mentally, but I haven't the courage of my views, as I said before. I didn't marry him altogether because of the scandal. But sometimes a woman's love of being loved gets the better of her conscience, and though she is agonized at the thought of treating a man cruelly, she encourages him to love her while she doesn't love him at all. Then when she sees him suffering, her remorse sets in, and she does what she can to repair the wrong." "You simply mean that you flirted outrageously with him, poor old chap, and then repented, and to make reparation, married him, though you tortured yourself to death by doing it." "Well, if you will put it brutally, it was a little like that, that and the scandal together, and your concealing for me what you thought to have told me before." He could see that she was distressed and tearful at his criticisms, and soothed her, saying, "There, dear, don't mind. Crucify me if you will. You know you are all the world to me, whatever you do." "I am very bad and unprincipled. I know you think that," she said, trying to blink away her tears. "I think and know you are my dear Sue, from whom neither length nor breadth, nor things present, nor things to come can divide me." Though so sophisticated in many things, she was such a child in others that this satisfied her, and they reached the end of their journey on the best of terms. It was about 10 o'clock when they arrived at Aldbrickham, the county town of North Wessex, and she would not go to the Temperance Hotel because of the form of his telegraph. Jude inquired for another, and a youth who volunteered to find one wheeled their luggage to the George farther on, which proved to be the inn at which Jude had stayed with Arabella on that one occasion of their meeting after their division for years. Owing, however, to their now entering it by another door, and to his preoccupation, he did not at first recognize the place. When they had engaged their respective rooms, they went down to a late supper. During Jude's temporary absence, the waiting maid spoke to Sue. "I think, ma'am, I remember your relation, or a friend, or whatever he is, coming here once before, late, just like this, with his wife, a lady at any rate. That wasn't you, by no manner of means, just as med be with you now." "Oh, do you?" said Sue, with a certain sickness of heart, "though I think you must be mistaken. How long ago was it?" "About a month or two. A handsome, full-figured woman. They had this room." When Jude came back and sat down to supper, Sue seemed moping and miserable. "Jude," she said to him plaintively, as they're parting that night upon the landing, "it is not so nice and pleasant as it used to be with us. I don't like it here, and I can't bear the place, and I don't like you so well as I did." "How fidgeted you seem, dear. Why do you change like this?" "Because it was cruel to bring me here." "Why?" "You were lately here with Arabella. There, now, I have said it." "Dear me, why," said Jude, looking round him. "Yes, it is the same. I really don't know it, Sue. Well, it's not cruel, since we have come as we have, two relations staying together." "How long ago was it you were here? Tell me, tell me." "The day before I met you in Christ Minister, when we went to Mary Green together, I told you I had met her." "Yes, you said you had met her, but you didn't tell me at all. Your story was that you had met as estranged people, who were not husband and wife at all in heaven's sight. Not that you had made it up with her. We didn't make it up, he said sadly. I can't explain, Sue. You've been false to me. You, my last hope, and I shall never forget it, never. But by your own wish, dear Sue, we are only friends, not lovers. It is so very inconsistent of you. Friends can be jealous. I don't see that. You concede nothing to me, and I have to concede everything to you. After all, you were on good terms with your husband at that time. No, I wasn't, Jude. Oh, how can you think so? And you have taken me in, even if you didn't intend to. She was so mortified that he was obliged to take her into her room and close the door, lest the people should hear. Was it this room? Yes, it was. I see by your look it was. I won't have it for mine. Oh, it was treacherous of you to have her again. I jumped out of the window. But, Sue, she was, after all, my legal wife, if not. Slipping down to her knees, Sue buried her face in the bed and wept. I never knew such an unreasonable, such a dog-in-the-manger feeling, said Jude. I'm not to approach you, nor anybody else. Oh, don't you understand my feeling? Why don't you? Why are you so gross? I jumped out of the window. Jumped out of the window? I can't explain. It was true that he did not understand her feelings very well, but he did a little and began to love her nonetheless. I thought you cared for nobody, desired nobody in the world but me at that time, and ever since, continued Sue. It is true I did not, and I don't now, said Jude, as distressed as she. But you must have thought much of her, or... No, I need not. You don't understand me either. Women never do. Why should you get into such a tantrum about nothing? Looking up from the quilt, she pouted provokingly. If it hadn't been for that, perhaps I would have gone on to the Temperance Hotel after all, as you proposed, for I was beginning to think I did belong to you. Oh, it is of no consequence, said Jude distantly. I thought, of course, that she had never really been your wife since she left you of her own accord years and years ago. My sense of it was that a parting such as yours from her and mine from him ended the marriage. I can't say more without speaking against her, and I don't want to do that, said he. Yet I must tell you one thing, which would settle the matter in any case. She has married another man, really married him. I knew nothing about it till after the visit we made here. Married another? It is a crime, as the world treats it, but does not believe. There, now you are yourself again. Yes, it is a crime, as you don't hold but would fearfully concede. But I shall never reform against her, and it is evidently a prick of conscience in her that has led her to urge me to get a divorce, that she may remarry this man legally. So you perceive I shall not be likely to see her again. And you didn't really know anything of this when you saw her, said Sue more gently as she rose. I did not. Considering all things, I don't think you ought to be angry, darling. I am not, but I shan't go to the Temperance Hotel. He laughed. Never mind, he said. So that I am near you, I am comparatively happy. It is more than this earthly wretch called me deserves. You spirit, you disembodied creature, you dear, sweet, tantalizing phantom, hardly flesh at all, so that when I put my arms round you, I almost expect them to pass through you through the air. Forgive me for being gross, as you call it. Remember that our calling cousins when really strangers was a snare. The enmity of our parents gave a piquancy to you in my eyes that was intenser even than the novelty of ordinary new acquaintance. Say those pretty lines, then, from Shelley's Epipsychidion, as if they meant me, she solicited, slanting up closer to him as they stood. Don't you know them? I know hardly any poetry, he replied mournfully. Don't you? These are some of them. There was a being whom my spirit oft met on its visions wandering far aloft, a seraph of heaven, too gentle to be human, veiling beneath that radiant form of a woman. Oh, it is too flattering, so I won't go on. But say it's me, say it's me. It is you, dear, exactly like you. Now I forgive you, and you shall kiss me just once, there, not very long. She put the tip of her finger gingerly to her cheek, and he did as commanded. You do care for me very much, don't you, in spite of my not, you know? Yes, sweet, he said with a sigh, and bid her good night.
Chapter 6. In returning to his native town of Shaston as schoolmaster, Phillotson had won the interest and awakened the memories of the inhabitants, who, though they did not honor him for his miscellaneous acquirements as he would have been honored elsewhere, retained for him a sincere regard. When shortly after his arrival he brought home a pretty wife, awkwardly pretty for him if he did not take care, they said, they were glad to have her settle among them. For some time after her flight from that home, Sue's absence did not excite comment. Her place as monitor in the school was taken by another young woman within a few days of her vacating it, which substitution also passed without remark, Sue's services having been of a provisional nature only. When, however, a month had passed, and Phillotson casually admitted to an acquaintance that he did not know where his wife was staying, curiosity began to be aroused, till jumping to conclusions, people ventured to affirm that Sue had played him false and run away from him. The schoolmaster's growing languor and listlessness over his work gave countenance to the idea. Though Phillotson had held his tongue as long as he could, except to his friend Gillingham, his honesty and directness would not allow him to do so when misapprehensions as to Sue's conduct spread abroad. On a Monday morning, the chairman of the school committee called, and after attending to the business of the school, drew Phillotson aside out of earshot of the children. "You'll excuse my asking, Phillotson, since everybody is talking of it, is this true as to your domestic affairs, that your wife's going away was on no visit, but a secret elopement with a lover? If so, I condole with you." "Don't," said Phillotson. "There was no secret about it." "She has gone to visit friends?" "No." "Then what has happened?" "She has gone away under circumstances that usually call for condolence with the husband, but I gave my consent." The chairman looked as if he had not apprehended the remark. "What I say is quite true," Phillotson continued testily. "She asked leave to go away with her lover, and I let her. Why shouldn't I? A woman of full age, it was a question of her own conscience, not for me. I was not her jailer. I can't explain any further. I don't wish to be questioned." The children observed that much seriousness marked the faces of the two men, and went home and told their parents that something new had happened about Mrs. Phillotson. Then Phillotson's little maidservant, who was just a schoolgirl just out of her standards, said that Mr. Phillotson had helped in his wife's packing, had offered her what money she required, and had written a friendly letter to her young man, telling him to take care of her. The chairman of committee thought the matter over and talked to the other managers of the school till a request came to Phillotson to meet them privately. The meeting lasted a long time, and at the end the schoolmaster came home, looking as usual pale and worn. Gillingham was sitting in his house awaiting him. "Well, it is as you said," observed Phillotson, flinging himself down wearily in a chair. "They have requested me to send in my resignation on account of my scandalous conduct in giving my tortured wife her liberty, or, as they call it, condoning her adultery, but I shan't resign." "I think I would." "I won't. It's no business of theirs. It doesn't affect me in my public capacity at all. They may expel me if they like." "If you make a fuss, it will get into the papers, and you'll never get appointed to another school. You see, they have to consider what you did as done by a teacher of youth, and its effects as such upon the morals of the town, and to ordinary opinion your position is indefensible. You must let me say that." To this good advice, however, Phillotson would not listen. "I don't care," he said. "I don't go unless I am turned out, and for this reason, that by resigning I acknowledge I have acted wrongly by her, when I am more and more convinced every day that in the sight of heaven and by all natural, straightforward humanity, I have acted rightly." Gillingham saw that his rather headstrong friend would not be able to maintain such a position as this, but he said nothing further, and in due time, indeed in a quarter of an hour, the formal letter of dismissal arrived, the managers having remained behind to write it after Phillotson's withdrawal. The latter replied that he should not accept dismissal, and called a public meeting, which he attended, although he looked so weak and ill that his friend implored him to stay at home. When he stood up to give his reasons for contesting the decision of the managers, he advanced them firmly, as he had done to his friend, and continued, moreover, that the matter was a domestic theory which did not concern them. This they overruled, insisting that the private eccentricities of a teacher came quite within their sphere of control, as it touched the morals of those he taught. Phillotson replied that he did not see how an act of natural charity could injure morals. All the respectable inhabitants and well-to-do fellow natives of the town were against Phillotson to a man. But somewhat to his surprise, some dozen or more champions rose up in his defense as from the ground. It has been stated that Shaston was an anchorage of a curious and interesting group of itinerants who frequented the numerous fairs and markets held up and down Wessex during the summer and autumn months. Although Phillotson had never spoke to one of these gentlemen, they now nobly led the forlorn hope in his defense. The body included two cheap jacks, a shooting gallery proprietor, and the ladies who loaded the guns, a pair of boxing masters, a steam roundabout manager, two traveling broom makers who called themselves widows, a gingerbread stallkeeper, a swingboat owner, and a test-your-strength man. This generous phalanx of supporters and a few others of independent judgment, whose own domestic experience had not been without vicissitude, came up and warmly shook hands with Phillotson, after which they expressed their thoughts so strongly to the meeting that issue was joined, the result being a general scuffle, wherein a blackboard was split, three panes of the school windows were broken, an ink bottle was spilled over a town councillor's shirt front, a church warden was dealt such a topper with a map of Palestine that his head went right through Samaria, and many black eyes and bleeding noses were given, one of which, to everybody's horror, was the venerable incumbent's, owing to the zeal of an emancipated chimney sweep, who took the side of Phillotson's party. When Phillotson saw the blood running down the rector's face, he deplored almost in groans the untoward and degrading circumstances, regretting that he had not resigned when called upon, and went home so ill that next morning he could not leave his bed. The farcical yet melancholy event was the beginning of a serious illness for him, and he lay in his lonely bed in the pathetic state of mind of a middle-aged man who perceives at length that his life, intellectual and domestic, is tending to failure and gloom. Gillingham came to see him in the evenings, and on one occasion mentioned Sue's name. "She doesn't care anything about me," said Phillotson. "Why should she?" "She doesn't know you are ill." "So much the better for both of us." "Where are her lover and she living?" "At Melchester, I suppose. At least he was living there some time ago." When Gillingham reached home, he sat and reflected, and at last wrote an anonymous line to Sue, on the bare chance of its reaching her, the letter being enclosed in an envelope addressed to Jude at the diocesan capital. Arriving at that place, it was forwarded to Mary Green in North Wessex, and thence to Albrickham by the only person who knew his present address, the widow who had nursed his aunt. 3 days later in the evening, when the sun was going down in splendor over the lowlands of Blackmoor and making the Shaston windows like tongues of fire to the eyes of the rustics in that vale, the sick man fancied that he heard somebody come to the house, and a few minutes after there was a tap at the bedroom door. Phillotson did not speak. The door was hesitatingly opened, and there entered Sue. She was in light spring clothing, and her advent seemed ghostly, like the flitting in of a moth. He turned his eyes upon her and flushed, but appeared to check his primary impulse to speak. "I have no business here," she said, bending her frightened face to him, "but I heard you were ill, very ill, and as I know that you recognize other feelings between man and woman than physical love, I have come." "I am not very ill, my dear friend, only unwell." "I didn't know that, and I am afraid that only a severe illness would have justified my coming." "Yes, yes, and I almost wish you had not come. It is a little too soon, that's all I mean. Still, let us make the best of it. You haven't heard about the school, I suppose?" "No, what about it?" "Only that I am going away from here to another place. The managers and I don't agree, and we are going to part, that's all." Sue did not for a moment, either now or later, suspect what troubles had resulted to him from letting her go. It never once seemed to cross her mind, and she had received no news whatever from Shaston. They talked on slight and ephemeral subjects, and when his tea was brought up, he told the amazed little servant that a cup was to be set for Sue. That young person was much more interested in their history than they supposed, and as she descended the stairs, she lifted her eyes and hands in grotesque amazement. While they sipped, Sue went to the window and thoughtfully said, "It is such a beautiful sunset, Richard." "They are most beautiful from here, owing to the rays crossing the mist of the veil. But I lose them all, as they don't shine into this gloomy corner where I lie. Wouldn't you like to see this particular one? It is like heaven opened." "Ah, yes, but I can't." "I'll help you to." "No, the bedstead can't be shifted." "But see how I mean." She went to where a swing glass stood, and taking it in her hands, carried it to a spot by the window where it could catch the sunshine, moving the glass till the beams were reflected in Phillotson's face. "There! You can see the great red sun now," she said, "and I am sure it will cheer you. I do so hope it will." She spoke with a childlike, repentant kindness, as if she could not do too much for him. Phillotson smiled sadly. "You are an odd creature," he murmured as the sun glowed in his eyes. "The idea of your coming to see me after what has passed." "Don't let us go back upon that," she said quickly. "I have to catch the omnibus for the train, as Jude doesn't know I have come. He was out when I started, so I must return home almost directly." "Richard, I am so very glad you are better. You don't hate me, do you? You have been such a kind friend to me." "I am glad to know you think so," said Phillotson huskily. "No, I don't hate you." It grew dusk quickly in the gloomy room during their intermittent chat, and when candles were brought and it was time to leave, she put her hand in his, or rather allowed it to flit through his, for she was significantly light in touch. She had nearly closed the door when he said, "Sue." He had noticed that in turning away from him, tears were on her face and a quiver in her lip. It was bad policy to recall her. He knew it while he pursued it, but he could not help it. She came back. "Sue," he murmured, "do you wish to make it up and stay? I'll forgive you and condone everything." "Oh, you can't, you can't," she said hastily. "You can't condone it now." "He is your husband now, in effect, you mean, of course." "You may assume it. He is obtaining a divorce from his wife, Arabella." "His wife? It is altogether news to me that he has a wife." "It was a bad marriage." "Like yours." "Like mine. He is not doing it so much on his own account as on hers. She wrote and told him it would be a kindness to her, since then she could marry and live respectably, and Jude has agreed." "A wife, a kindness to her." "Ah, yes, a kindness to release her altogether. But I don't like the sound of it. I can forgive, Sue." "No, no, you can't have me back now I've been so wicked, as to do what I have done." There had arisen in Sue's face that incipient fright which showed itself whenever he changed from friend to husband, and which made her adopt any line of defense against marital feeling in him. "I must go now. I'll come again, may I?" "I don't ask you to go, even now. I ask you to stay." "I thank you, Richard, but I must. As you are not so ill as I thought, I cannot stay." "She's his. His from lips to heel," said Phillotson, but so faintly that in closing the door she did not hear it. The dread of a reactionary change in the schoolmaster's sentiments, coupled perhaps with a faint shamefacedness at letting him even know what a slipshod lack of thoroughness, from a man's point of view, characterized her transferred allegiance, prevented her telling him of her thus far incomplete relations with Jude, and Phillotson lay writhing like a man in hell as he pictured the prettily dressed, maddening compound of sympathy and averseness who bore his name, returning impatiently to the home of her lover. Gillingham was so interested in Phillotson's affairs and so seriously concerned about him that he walked up the hillside to Shaston two or three times a week, although there and back it was a journey of 9 miles, which had to be performed between tea and supper after a hard day's work in school. When he called on the next occasion after Sue's visit, his friend was downstairs, and Gillingham noticed that his restless mood had been supplanted by a more fixed and composed one. "She's been here since you called last," said Phillotson. "Not Mrs. Phillotson?" "Yes." "Ah, you have made it up?" "No, she just came, patted my pillow with her little white hand, played the thoughtful nurse for half an hour, and went away." "Well, I'm hanged! A little hussy!" "What do you say?" "Oh, nothing." "What do you mean?" "I mean, what a tantalizing, capricious little woman, if she were not your wife." "She is not. She's another man's, except in name and law. And I have been thinking, it was suggested to me by a conversation I had with her, that in kindness to her, I ought to dissolve the legal tie altogether, which, singularly enough, I think I can do, now she has been back and refused my request to stay after I said I had forgiven her. I believe that fact would afford me opportunity of doing it, though I did not see it at the moment. What's the use of keeping her chained on to me if she doesn't belong to me? I know, I feel absolutely certain, that she would welcome my taking such a step as the greatest charity to her. For though as fellow creature she sympathizes with and pities me, and even weeps for me, as a husband she cannot endure me. She loathes me. There's no use in mincing words. She loathes me, and my only manly and dignified and merciful course is to complete what I have begun. And for worldly reasons, too, it will be better for her to be independent. I have hopelessly ruined my prospects because of my decision as to what was best for us, although she does not know it. I see only dire poverty ahead from my feet to the grave, for I can be accepted as teacher no more. I shall probably have enough to do to make both ends meet during the remainder of my life, now my occupation's gone, and I shall be better able to bear it alone. I may as well tell you that what has suggested my letting her go is some news she brought me, the news that Folly is doing the same. Oh, he had a spouse, too? A queer couple, these lovers. Well, I don't want your opinion on that. What I was going to say is that my liberating her can do her no possible harm, and will open up a chance of happiness for her which she has never dreamt of hitherto, for then they'll be able to marry as they ought to have done at first. Gillingham did not hurry to reply. I may disagree with your motive, he said gently, for he respected views he could not share. But I think you are right in your determination, if you can carry it out. I doubt, however, if you can.
Hardy begins Part 5, At Albricum and Elsewhere, with a quote from M. Antoninus. Thy aerial part, and all the fairy parts which are mingled in thee, though by nature they have an upward tendency, still in obedience to the disposition of the universe, they are overpowered here in the compound mass, the body.
Chapter 1. How Gillingham's doubts were disposed of will most quickly appear by passing over the series of dreary months and incidents that followed the events of the last chapter, and coming on to a Sunday in the February of the year following. Sue and Jude were living in Aldbrickham, in precisely the same relations that they had established between themselves when she left Shaston to join him the year before. The proceedings in the law courts had reached their consciousness, but as a distant sound and an occasional missive, which they hardly understood. They had met, as usual, to breakfast together in the little house with Jude's name on it, that he had taken at £15 a year, with £3.10 extra for rates and taxes, and furnished with his aunt's ancient and lumbering goods, which had cost him about their full value to bring all the way from Marygreen. Sue kept house and managed everything. As he entered the room this morning, Sue held up a letter she had just received. "Well, and what is it about?" he said, after kissing her. "That the decree nisi, in the case of Philistine versus Philistine and Folly, pronounced 6 months ago, has just been made absolute." "Ah," said Jude as he sat down. The same concluding incident in Jude's suit against Arabella had occurred about a month or two earlier. Both cases had been too insignificant to be reported in the papers, further than by name in a long list of other undefended cases. "Now then, Sue, at any rate, you can do what you like," he looked at his sweetheart curiously. "Are we, you and I, just as free now as if we had never married at all?" "Just as free, except I believe that a clergyman may object personally to remarry you and hand the job on to somebody else. But I wonder, do you think it is really so with us? I know it is generally, but I have an uncomfortable feeling that my freedom has been obtained under false pretenses."
"How?"
"Well, if the truth about us had been known, the decree wouldn't have been pronounced. It is only, is it, because we have made no defense, and have led them into a false supposition? Therefore, is my freedom lawful, however proper it may be?"
"Well, why did you let it be under false pretenses? You have only yourself to blame," he said mischievously.
"Jude, don't. You ought not to be touchy about that still. You must take me as I am."
"Very well, darling, so I will. Perhaps you were right. As to your question, we were not obliged to prove anything. That was their business. Anyhow, we are living together."
"Yes, though not in their sense."
"One thing is certain, that however the decree may be brought about, a marriage is dissolved when it is dissolved. There is this advantage in being poor, obscure people like us, that these things are done for us in a rough and ready fashion. It was the same with me and Arabella. I was afraid her criminal second marriage would have been discovered and she punished. But nobody took any interest in her. Nobody inquired. Nobody suspected it. If we'd been patented nobilities, we should have had infinite trouble, and days and weeks would have been spent in investigations." By degrees, Sue acquired her lover's cheerfulness at the sense of freedom, and proposed that they should take a walk in the fields, even if they had to put up with a cold dinner on account of it. Jude agreed, and Sue went upstairs and prepared to start, putting on a joyful, colored gown in observance of her liberty, seeing which Jude put on a lighter tie. "Now we'll strut arm and arm," he said, "like any other engaged couple. We've a legal right to." They rambled out of the town, and along a path over the low-lying lands that bordered it, though these were frosty now, and the extensive seed fields were bare of color and produce. The pair, however, were so absorbed in their own situation that their surroundings were little in their consciousness.
"Well, my dearest, the result of all this is that we can marry after a decent interval."
"Yes, I suppose we can," said Sue, without enthusiasm.
"And aren't we going to?"
"I don't like to say no, dear Jude, but I feel just the same about it now as I have done all along. I have just the same dread lest an iron contract should extinguish your tenderness for me and mine for you as it did between our unfortunate parents."
"Still, what can we do? I do love you, as you know, Sue."
"I know it abundantly, but I think I would much rather go on living always as lovers as we are living now, and only meeting by day. It is so much sweeter, for the woman at least, and when she is sure of the man. And henceforward we needn't be so particular as we have been about our appearances."
"Our experiences of matrimony with others have not been encouraging, I own," said he with some gloom, "either owing to our own dissatisfied, unpractical natures, or by our misfortune. But we two should be two dissatisfied ones linked together, which would be twice as bad as before. I think I should begin to be afraid of you, Jude, the moment you had contracted to cherish me under a government stamp, and I was licensed to be loved on by the premises by you. Oh, how horrible and sordid! Although, as you are free, I trust you more than any man in the world."
"No, no, don't say I should change," he expostulated, yet there was misgiving in his own voice also. "Apart from ourselves, and our unhappy peculiarities, it is foreign to a man's nature to go on loving a person when he is told that he must and shall be that person's lover. There would be a much likelier chance of his doing it if he were told not to love. If the marriage ceremony consisted in an oath and signed contract between the parties to cease loving from that day forward in consideration of personal possession being given, and to avoid each other's society as much as possible in public, there would be more loving couples than there are now. Fancy the secret meetings between the perjuring husband and wife, the denials of having seen each other, the clambering in at bedroom windows, and the hiding in closets. There'd be little cooling then.
Yes, but admitting this, or something like it, to be true, you're not the only one in the world to see it, dear little Sue. People go on marrying because they can't resist natural forces, and although many of them may know perfectly well that they are possibly buying a month's pleasure with a life's discomfort, no doubt my father and mother and your father and mother saw it, if they at all resembled us in habits of observation. But then they went and married just the same, because they had ordinary passions. But you, Sue, are such a phantasmal, bodiless creature, one who, if you'll allow me to say it, has so little animal passion in you, that you can act upon reason in the matter, when we poor unfortunate wretches of grosser substance can't.
Well, she sighed, you've owed that it would probably end in misery for us, and I am not so exceptional a woman as you think. Fewer women like marriage than you suppose, only they enter into it for the dignity it is assumed to confer, and the social advantages it gains them sometimes, a dignity and an advantage that I am quite willing to do without.
Jude fell back upon his old complaint, that, intimate as they were, he had never once had from her an honest, candid declaration that she loved or could love him. "I really fear sometimes that you cannot," he said, with dubiousness approaching anger. "And you are so reticent. I know that women are taught by other women that they must never admit the full truth to a man. But the highest form of affection is based on full sincerity on both sides. Not being men, these women don't know that in looking back on those he has had tender relations with, a man's heart returns closest to her who is the soul of truth in her conduct. The better class of man, even if caught by airy affectations of dodging and parrying, is not retained by them. A nemesis attends the woman who plays the game of elusiveness too often, in the utter contempt for her that sooner or later her old admirers feel, under which they allow her to go unlamented to her grave. Sue, who was regarding the distance, had acquired a guilty look, and she suddenly replied in a tragic voice, "I don't think I like you today so well as I did, Jude."
"Don't you? Why?"
"Oh, well, you are not nice, too sermony, though I suppose I am so bad and worthless that I deserve the utmost rigor of lecturing." "No, you are not bad, you are a dear, but as slippery as an eel when I want to get a confession from you." "Oh, yes, I am bad and obstinate and all sorts. It is no use your pretending that I am not. People who are good don't want scolding as I do. But now that I have nobody but you and nobody to defend me, it is very hard that I mustn't have my own way in deciding how I'll live with you and whether I'll be married or no."
"Sue, my own comrade and sweetheart, I don't want to force you to either marry or to do the other thing. Of course I don't. It is too wicked of you to be so pettish. Now, we won't say any more about it, and go on, just the same, as we have done. And during the rest of our walk, we'll talk of the meadows only, and the floods, and the prospect of the farmers this coming year."
After this, the subject of marriage was not mentioned by them for several days, though living as they were with only a landing between them, it was constantly in their minds. Sue was assisting Jude very materially now. He had latterly occupied himself on his own account in working and lettering headstones, which he kept in a little yard at the back of his little house, where in the intervals of domestic duties she marked out the letters full size for him,
and blacked them in after he had cut them. It was a lower class of handicraft than were his former performances as a cathedral mason, and his only patrons were the poor people who lived in his own neighborhood and knew what a cheap man this Jude Fawley, monumental mason, as he called himself on his front door, was to employ for the simple memorials they required for their dead. But he seemed more independent than before, and it was the only arrangement under which Sue, who particularly wished to be no burden on him, could render any assistance.
Chapter 2. It was an evening at the end of the month, and Jude had just returned home from hearing a lecture on ancient history in the public hall not far off. When he entered, Sue, who had been keeping indoors during his absence, laid out supper for him. Contrary to custom, she did not speak. Jude had taken up some illustrated paper, which he perused till, raising his eyes, he saw that her face was troubled. "Are you depressed, Sue?" he said. She paused a moment. "I have a message for you," she answered. "Somebody has called?" "Yes, a woman." Sue's voice quavered as she spoke, and she suddenly sat down from her preparations, laid her hands in her lap, and looked into the fire. "I don't know whether I did right or not," she continued. "I said you were not at home, and when she said she would wait, I said I thought you might not be able to see her."
"Why did you say that, dear?"
"I suppose she wanted a headstone. Was she in mourning?" "No, she wasn't in mourning, and she didn't want a headstone, and I thought you couldn't see her." Sue looked critically and imploringly at him.
"But who was she? Didn't she say?"
"No, she wouldn't give her name. But I know who she was. I think I do. It was Arabella."
"Heaven save us! What should Arabella come for? What made you think it was she?"
"Oh, I can hardly tell. But I know it was. I feel perfectly certain it was. By the light in her eyes as she looked at me, she was a fleshy, coarse woman."
"Well, I should not have called Arabella coarse exactly, except in speech. Though she may be getting so by this time, under the duties of the public house. She was rather handsome when I knew her."
"Handsome, but yes, so she is."
"I think I heard a quiver in your little mouth. Well, waiving that, as she is nothing to me, and virtuously married to another man, why should she come troubling us?"
"Are you sure she's married? Have you definite news of it?"
"No, not definite news. But that was why she asked me to release her. She and the man both wanted to lead a proper life, as I understood."
"Oh, Jude, it was Arabella," cried Sue, covering her eyes with her hand. "And I am so miserable. It seems such an ill omen, whatever she may have come for. You could not possibly see her, could you?"
"I don't really think I could. It would be so very painful to talk to her now. For her as much as for me. However, she's gone. Did she say she would come again?"
"No, but she went away very reluctantly."
Sue, whom the least thing upset, could not eat any supper, and when Jude had finished his, he prepared to go to bed. He had no sooner raked out the fire, fastened the doors, and got to the top of the stairs, than there came a knock. Sue instantly emerged from her room, which she had but just entered.
"There she is again," Sue whispered in appalled accents.
"How do you know?"
"She knocked, just like last time."
They listened, and the knocking came again. No servant was kept in the house, and if the summons were to be responded to, one of them would have to do it in person. "I'll open a window," said Jude. "Whoever it is cannot be expected to be let in at this time." He accordingly went into his bedroom and lifted the sash. The lonely street of early retiring workpeople was empty from end to end, save of one figure, that of a woman
walking up and down by a lamp a few yards off. "Who's there?" he asked.
"Is that Mr. Fawley?"
came up from the woman in a voice which was unmistakably Arabella's. Jude replied that it was.
"Is it she?"
asked Sue from the door, with lips apart. "Yes, dear," said Jude. "What do you want, Arabella?" he inquired.
"I beg your pardon, Jude, for disturbing you," said Arabella humbly. "But I called earlier. I wanted particularly to see you tonight, if I could. I'm in trouble, and have nobody to help me."
"In trouble, are you?"
"Yes."
There was a silence. An inconvenient sympathy seemed to be rising in Jude's breast at the appeal. "But aren't you married?" he said. Arabella hesitated.
"No, Jude, I'm not," she returned. "He wouldn't, after all. And I am in great difficulty. I hope to get another situation as barmaid soon, but it takes time, and I really am in great distress because of a sudden responsibility that's been sprung on me from Australia. Or I wouldn't trouble you. Believe me, I wouldn't. I want to tell you about it."
Sue remained at gaze, in painful tension, hearing every word, but speaking none. "You're really not in want of money, Arabella?" he asked, in a distinctly softened tone.
"I have enough to pay for the night's lodging I have obtained, but barely enough to take me back again."
"Where are you living?"
"In London still."
She was about to give the address, but she said,
"I'm afraid somebody may hear, so I don't like to call out particulars of myself so loud. If you could come down and walk a little way with me towards the Prince Inn, where I'm staying tonight, I would explain all. You may as well, for old time's sake."
"Poor thing. I must do her the kindness of hearing what's the matter, I suppose," said Jude in much perplexity. "As she's going back tomorrow, it can't make much difference."
"But you can go and see her tomorrow, Jude. Don't go now, Jude,"
came in plaintive accents from the doorway.
"Oh, it is only to entrap you. I know it is, as she did before. Don't go, dear. She's such a low-passioned woman. I can see it in her shape and hear it in her voice."
"But I shall go," said Jude. "Don't attempt to detain me, Sue. God knows I love her little enough now, but I don't want to be cruel to her." He turned to the stairs.
"But she's not your wife," cried Sue distractedly.
"And you are not either, dear, yet," said Jude.
"Oh, but are you going to her? Don't! Stay at home! Please, please stay at home, Jude, and not go to her. Now she's not your wife any more than I."
"Well, she is rather more than you, come to that," he said, taking his hat determinedly. "I've wanted you to be, and I've waited with the patience of Job, and I don't see that I've got anything by my self-denial. I shall certainly give her something, and hear what it is she is so anxious to tell me. No man could do less." There was that in his manner which she knew it would be futile to oppose. She said no more, but, turning to her room as meekly as a martyr, heard him go downstairs, unbolt the door, and close it behind him. With a woman's disregard for dignity when in the presence of nobody but herself, she also trotted down, sobbing articulately as she went. She listened. She knew exactly how far it was to the inn that Arabella had named as her lodging. It would occupy about 7 minutes to get there at an ordinary walking pace, 7 to come back again. If he did not return in 14 minutes, he would have lingered. She looked at the clock. It was 11:25. He might enter the inn with Arabella, as they would reach it before closing time. She might get him to drink with her, and heaven only knew what disasters would befall him then.
Well, that's it for this program of readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Check back with us at the same time next week. We'll read another episode. Meanwhile, thanks from me. Thanks from today's readers. Glad to have you tuning in. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a good day.